You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story of Gods and Men by Karen Valby. Hemsworth's hero is his father, whom he describes as a lion of a man. His father was his date to the premiere of his first movie, Star Trek, in 2009. I only had three or four lines. At the end, he just reached over and gave me a big kiss on the head and a cuddle, and he told me many times how proud he was of me. Certainly, in my times of doubt, I see both him and my mom, and I go, okay, I must be on the right track. Craig Hemsworth spent his career as a social worker with the Department of Human Services, specializing in cases of childhood violence and neglect. I saw the toll that took on him, says Hemsworth. He'd have to present evidence of whether or not this was a safe environment for this kid to be in. And if it isn't, well, then imagine the ripple effects for that child and those parents and that family. Whether he prevented something bad from happening in one case, there was always another one. Hemsworth seems surprised by a bog of tears in his throat as he relates all this, and he pauses until it passes. I hope that sums up what an incredible person he is. He is the most generous person you'll ever meet. There for anyone. He clears his throat and gives himself another moment. When Hemsworth was little, he remembers going to the neighborhood park with his father and happening upon some rowdy-looking teenagers smashing bottles on the playground. His father walked over and told them to clean up their mess. Hemsworth watched with mounting anxiety as the boys refused. I just remember Dad very firmly saying, "My son got 6 stitches in his foot last week because he cut his foot here on a broken bottle. Don't cross me on this one, guys. Get to work." And they did. They picked up the glass. And I remember knowing that's who you have to be, but lacking the confidence in myself, trying to stand up to people and just being scared out of my mind and being really upset because my dad wouldn't be afraid, you know. He never put that on me, ever. But having that role model was both an inspiration and intimidating, you know. Luke tells me a story about how he and his brother liked to take their families surfing at the nearby popular Watego's Beach because the waves there are the best for kids and beginners. But lately, the brothers have noticed how selfish the more experienced surfers can be, lashing out at kids when they interrupt their precious shot at a perfect wave. The Hemsworth boys learned to surf with their dad on Phillip Island in Victoria and on holiday in Mallacoota, where the old guys showed them true aloha spirit. When you'd paddle out, Luke says, they would yell, "Go, Grommet, go, off you go." Now there's so many surfers here who can get really mean to kids. Chris doesn't suffer bullies, so when he sees grown adults being dangerous or mean towards kids, he's quite happy to have a quiet word with them, or a loud one. Later, Hemsworth tells me what got him so choked up while talking about his dad. After Limitless revealed his own copies of the APOE4 gene, the whole family underwent genetic testing. His father carries the gene as well, as did his grandfather, who died last year after a long battle with Alzheimer's. Craig has begun confronting early signs of the disease. I know my dad is going through a transition of acceptance around, "I'm not this big strong man with all the answers, who everybody looks to for guidance now," Hemsworth says. He shakes his head, wondering aloud on how best to honor who his father was and who he sees him becoming. He's much more the observer now, rather than leading the pack. It's a reminder to me, because those are exactly the qualities I need: stillness, observation, absorption, a respect for the present moment. Hemsworth's parents came over to his place for dinner after he and I visited out on the deck. They talked about the future, he tells me, about how much living there is left to do, but also about the inevitable transition all families face as generations reverse roles. We don't want anyone we love to suffer, but what we can focus on is our attitude and perspective, says Hemsworth. I have a great sense of nostalgia for how life is changing, but I don't look at any of this like, oh no, time is running out, what a tragedy. I feel like, well then, get going, be involved, and stay present, and don't get caught up in all the rubbish that I may have spent a large chunk of my adult life doing. What a gift it is to be able to love so deeply and be loved. What else is there, really, that we're here for? In Hemsworth's family room, there's a large black-and-white David Yarrow photograph of a lion hanging above the fireplace. The animal is poised in mid-leap, as if in ferocious embrace of whatever awaits. I ask Hemsworth if the photo is an homage at all to his lion-hearted father. I hadn't thought of that, he says, but it'll make me think of him now. Hemsworth has never gone horseback riding out on the local beach. His wife and daughter are both competitive riders and find this lapse inexcusable. So Mom and Dad decide to let India skip the next morning of school. I'll meet Hemsworth at the house, and India and her mother will drive separately to the beach with the horses. We set a time, but in the morning, Hemsworth text to ask if I'd mind arriving a little later than planned, just running a bit late with school drop. When I arrive, three boys I don't recognize are roughhousing with a Thor hammer in the kitchen, while their little brother sits on the wood floor, gazing happily at his favorite actor. Hemsworth introduces the crew as new friends visiting on holiday, to which the mother, a look of enormous gratitude on her face, corrects him, best friends. On the drive to the beach, Hemsworth tells me that his guests were in town on a Starlight Children's Foundation trip. The young boy's wish was to meet Thor. 2 days ago, Hemsworth spent the afternoon with all four brothers, swimming and playing games. After the family returned to their hotel, the boy noticed that the actor's autograph on his new Thor hammer had smeared. When their flight home got delayed, the mom asked if they could return to the house to have Hemsworth redo it. Hemsworth worried it could seem like he'd orchestrated some self-aggrandizing scene and tried to plan for me to miss it altogether. At the beachfront, I meet his wife Pataki, who is sparkly-eyed and lovely, and happy to learn that I rode horses as a child, just like India, named for Indiana Jones. Indy's the best rider in the family, says Hemsworth. Even when she falls off, she's more angry than she is afraid. Get me back on that horse. When India was 5 years old, she desperately wanted to be a dragon, Hemsworth tells me. She came to me one night with little tears in her eyes and said, I'm just never going to be a dragon, no matter what I do. And I said to her, no, I don't think so. But you could go to sleep and dream of being a dragon and all the cool things you could do. She goes, okay, cool, and ran off to bed really excited. At bedtime, Hemsworth used to read India, oh, the places you'll go. He even got a tattoo of the Dr. Seuss character on the inside of his left arm. Recently, he decided the tattoo was a little corny, and he started laser removal sessions. India goes, what's happening? He's rubbing off. And I was like, yeah, but maybe it's a bit waffly to have a cartoon character on my arm. And she said, no, we love that book, and you got the tattoo for me. So the tattoo stays, fuzzy and faded. On the beach, Hemsworth opts for a Western saddle on his horse, Dolly, named after Dolly Parton. He wants to protect his back. He'll finally end up having surgery within the month, so he rides in a kind of quarter squat position that's tough on the knees. Between runs, we talk about the movies that make us cry. Pataki picks the never-ending story. India is stumped, but her mother says she spotted wet cheeks when they watched The Notebook in bed recently. Hemsworth says the family has a yearly date with It's a Wonderful Life, and without fail, the scene of the sodden, grieving druggist slapping a young George Bailey always breaks his heart anew. "Don't hurt my sore ear, Mr. Gower," Hemsworth whimpers, quoting the film. "I know you're upset because your son died." Jimmy Stewart, we agree. Now there was a movie star. Pataki suggests one more ride before heading home. India and I lead the pack, the girl looking over at me with a big open smile. We're cantering alongside each other when she calls out that she feels like her horse wants more speed. I nod and lean down over my horse's neck, loosening my reins and letting the animal go. And then all there is the sound of thundering hooves and India's ecstatic voice shouting that she thinks she spots a falcon on the sand in the distance. Could it be? It is a falcon. I don't fall off my horse, and Hemsworth doesn't have to further injure his back trying to save me, and the sun is so bright and the water so blue. An old man's two dogs try briefly to keep pace with our horses. And up ahead, a dad holds his baby under her arms while she splashes her fat little feet at the shoreline. Hemsworth is somewhere behind us, taking in the whole scene. "If he's a good father," he told me earlier, "it's because he learned from the best." So here we all are on the edge of the ocean. The truth of our lives is that nothing is promised, and everything will be taken. But in this moment, we are so breathtakingly alive, an 11-year-old girl in a dragon t-shirt leading the way. From the portrait studio, the Gilded Age. Sports legends and music icons rubbed elbows with freshly minted Academy Award winners at the 30th anniversary Vanity Fair Oscar party. Photographs by Mark Seliger. Sittings editor Rebecca Ramsey. In the photos, Emma Stone, Academy Award winner for Best Actress in Poor Things, wearing Louis Vuitton and Louis Vuitton fine jewelry. LeBron James, wearing Louis Vuitton men's. Academy Award winners for Oppenheimer, producer Emma Thomas, wearing Rodarte, and writer, director, and producer Christopher Nolan, wearing Dior men. Jennifer Lawrence, wearing archival Givenchy haute couture with earrings by Brioni Raymond and a cuff and ring on her right hand by Belle Perron. Anya Taylor-Joy, wearing Miss Sohi with jewelry from Tiffany and Company Archives. Donald Glover, wearing Amiri with a necklace and rings by Boucheron and a watch by Vacheron Constantin. Davine Joy Randolph, Academy Award winner for Best Supporting Actress in The Holdovers, wearing Valdrin Sahiti with jewelry by De Beers. Billie Eilish, Academy Award winner for Best Song, What Was I Made For, from Barbie, wearing Vaquera with glasses and jewelry by Chrome Hearts. Mark Ruffalo, Academy Award nominee for Best Supporting Actor in Poor Things, wearing Givenchy. America Ferrera, Academy Award nominee for Best Supporting Actress in Barbie, wearing Versace, with jewelry by De Beers. Lily Gladstone, Academy Award nominee for Best Actress in Killers of the Flower Moon, wearing Gucci, in collaboration with Joe Big Mountain of Iron Horse Quill Work, with jewelry by Bulgari High Jewelry. Jeffrey Wright, Academy Award nominee for Best Actor in American Fiction, wearing Giorgio Armani Made to Measure with glasses by Oliver Peoples, a brooch by Chaumet, and a watch by Omega. Usher, wearing Valentino. Actor Jonathan Bailey, wearing Giorgio Armani. K-pop superstar Rosé of Blackpink, wearing Saint Laurent by Anthony Vaccarello. Tennis legends John McEnroe, wearing Dior Men with sneakers by Nike. And Serena Williams, wearing Off-White with a necklace by Messika High Jewelry and a watch by Audemars Piguet.
Thank you.
in vitro veritas more than half a century ago in a dusty Roman library. Men of science and men of faith gathered together to unlock the mysteries of female fertility. The answer? Urine from the brides of Christ. And lo, those nuns gaveth, by Keziah Weir, with illustrations by Mark Smith. Opening illustration shows a group of nuns in a town square with a beautiful fountain. On a spring day in Rome, 1957, the season of Pope Pius XII's Ash Wednesday, the 12th's Ash Wednesday Mass, wisteria blooming by the Spanish Steps, 30-year-old Bruno Lunenfeld gave one hell of a presentation. What he said had the potential to shape the course of history in ways even the Vatican couldn't foresee. Inside an imposing L-shaped building that stretched down Via Casilina and then along Via L'Aquila, in a wood-paneled library distinguished by rows of leather-bound books and cream floor tiles spangled with stars, the dozen or so board members of a pharmaceutical company listened as Lunenfeld described his findings. For 4 years, he had been developing a therapy that would induce ovulation in women struggling with infertility. What he needed now was the support of the Istituto Farmacologico Serono, whose own staff scientist, Piero Donini, had been working on a similar endeavor and who had facilitated Lunenfeld's trip from Israel to Rome. The men listened politely, but at the end of the presentation, they told him with regret that they couldn't help. They believed certain hurdles to be insurmountable. It seemed unlikely, for instance, that Serono would be able to procure the vast quantities of one specific essential substance without which the drug couldn't be made. Lunenfeld left the library. Nearly 70 years later, looking back, he won't be able to remember whether or not he was crying. What he does recall is that a member of the board by the name of Don Giulio Pacelli, pictures will show the Italian prince to have had the strong features and thick dark hair receding sharply at the temples of a Fellini heartthrob, approached him in his despair. Lunenfeld wasn't Italian or Catholic. He didn't realize the currency of Pacelli's name in a city like Rome, and certainly couldn't have understood his connection to the Pope. Still, the prince had something else to offer, equally potent and instantly recognizable: belief. "I have an idea," he said to Lunenfeld. "Let's talk." 30,000 liters. "I will tell you exactly the number of nuns we needed for the initial phase," Lunenfeld says to me. The 96-year-old endocrinologist is calling from his home on the Florida coast in Delray Beach, just a short drive from Boca Raton. He can't immediately find the figure in his files, but he assures me he knows he has it somewhere. I tell him I recall reading that it was 300 nuns. Could be, he says patiently. Then he locates the slide he was looking for. "No, I think we only had 100 nuns." Later, that number would expand. But over the first year, he says, we had 100 nuns recruited, which gave us 30,000 liters. And the 30,000 liters gave us 100 milligrams of the substance which we needed. And this was enough to make 9,000 vials of 75 units, sufficient for 450 ovulation induction cycles. What Lunenfeld is explaining is that it took 100 postmenopausal nuns 1 year to produce 30,000 liters of piss. All that urine, collected and processed by Serono, eventually helped create the drug Pergonol, which aided in the first successful IVF pregnancy in the United States, as well as countless pregnancies in vitro and otherwise worldwide, and in certain ways still does. Serono phased out Pergonol in 2004. Later that year, the nearly identical brand name competitor, Minopure, gained approval for use in the U.S. and remains a leading IVF drug today. In 2022, Minopure turned $802 million in global sales for Swiss-owned Ferring Pharmaceuticals. That fall, changes made in the manufacturing process of Minopure's ingredients caused a year-long global shortage, sending patients scrambling to internet pharmacies and online message boards, desperately searching for vials of the drug. For now, the supply chain has unkinked, at least as long as IVF is legal. In February, Alabama's Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos are people, with a concurring opinion by Chief Justice Tom Parker that quoted scripture. To continue IVF while complying with such a ruling would set assisted reproductive technology back decades. But the ruling is just the latest potential roadblock for a substance that, as Lunenfeld has described it, turned urine into gold on a road dotted at every turn with disparate and powerful men. The thing nobody tells you about trying to get pregnant is all the pee. There is, of course, the ubiquitous at-home pregnancy test. If it detects the presence of human chorionic gonadotropin, which the body begins producing shortly after implantation and is excreted in urine, the test flashes a smiley face or darkens a line, the happily ever after of the conception journey. But if you don't get pregnant the first time you glance unprotected at a penis, as some sixth-grade health classes may lead you to believe, you might purchase an ovulation predictor kit. The cheapest version of these are small test strips, which, when dipped into urine, measure the body's levels of luteinizing hormone, LH, a rise in which triggers ovulation. If you purchase a 50-pack on your cell phone late one night, your social media algorithm may start serving you alternative methods of pregnancy prediction, like the scientifically unfounded sugar test. Pee on sugar crystals and read them like tea leaves, approximately $5. Or more advanced tech, like the Mira, Inito, or Uva, to catch the fertile window by tracking LH, follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH, and more, pee on dipsticks and insert them into a digital device, $150 and up. Your acupuncturist might suggest the Dutch urine test, a $499 panel that provides a complete evaluation of sex and adrenal hormones. The instructions before a pelvic ultrasound will be to drink 32 ounces of water 1 hour prior, because a full bladder will help reposition the bowels for a clear view of the uterus. But after the external exam, the tech will send you to the bathroom to urinate because the intravaginal imaging requires an empty bladder. On the Trying for a Baby subreddit, a refrain, pee on everything. The G Club. Bruno Lunenfeld was born in 1927 to a wealthy Jewish family in Vienna. His father, David, was a lawyer whose office represented the House of Habsburg, a fierce opponent of Nazism. As Adolf Hitler's influence grew throughout the 30s, David began making plans for his family to escape the country, only to be detained by Nazi forces. In 1938, Bruno, a round-faced 11-year-old with wide, inquisitive blue eyes, joined a kinder transport bound for England. He would later learn that Nazi soldiers forced his father and uncle onto Dachau-bound transport train and that his uncle was shot and killed en route, while his father was later moved from Dachau to Buchenwald. While at a camp in Dovercourt, waiting to be placed with a British foster family, Lunenfeld took 10 British pounds, secreted into his sock by his mother, bought his own ticket to London, and found a policeman who eventually united him with an uncle living nearby. He attended various local boarding schools until 1940, when members of the French military reunited him with his parents, who had escaped to mandatory Palestine. It was not Israel at that point, Lunenfeld says, though he never understood how. At school in Tel Aviv, Lunenfeld struggled to learn Hebrew, having been raised on German and then English. Following the Italian Air Force's bombing of the city in September 1940, his parents enrolled him at St. George's, a British boarding school in Jerusalem. Lunenfeld became interested in studying medicine after a close friend died of polio, but Israel had no medical school. He ultimately earned his M.D. and Ph.D. at the University of Geneva, where, he notes ruefully, he worked in French. For his doctorate in endocrinology, Lunenfeld studied under Hubert de Witteville and Rudy Borth, who were working with the Swiss pharmaceutical firm Ciba to test an oral drug designed to ease the symptoms of menopause. During clinical trials on patients experiencing vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and brain fog, Lunenfeld and Borth began experimenting with the patient's urine, injecting small amounts into immature mice. Scientists already knew that urine contained hormones. In one early pregnancy test, developed in the 1930s, doctors injected rabbits with women's urine, then killed and dissected the animals to examine their ovaries, which developed growths in response to pregnancy hormones. Lunenfeld, Borth, and de Witteville hoped that the menopausal urine might hold answers to what caused the unpleasant symptoms. Instead, the injections caused the mice to ovulate, and even hyperovulate, in which ovarian follicles develop into one, but not one, but multiple mature eggs. Equally surprising was that after Lunenfeld treated the same menopausal women with a 90-day course of Ciba's drug, which contained estrogen and testosterone, the women's urine stopped the mice from becoming fertile. Lunenfeld and his professors hadn't simply stumbled upon a potential treatment for women experiencing amenorrhea, a lack of menstruation that can mean they're not ovulating. They had discovered a contraceptive, too. At the time, the research had limited funds provided by the Swiss government. We had to decide, are we going into the direction of contraception, or are we going in the direction of infertility? Lunenfeld says, I was biased, of course. This was just after the war, and so many people got killed. So I thought, maybe the better thing now is to go into infertility and help women who couldn't have babies to have babies. But Lunenfeld, Borth, and de Witteville couldn't simply begin injecting would-be mothers with human waste. We had to test biological studies, biochemical studies, biostatistical studies, and so on, Lunenfeld recalls. They didn't have the knowledge or manpower. At the time, Lunenfeld had just finished consulting on a film for Hoffmann La Roche, now known as Roche AG, one of the biggest public pharmaceutical companies in the world. The producer was a German refugee who'd caught the last train into Switzerland. Over dinner at a Geneva train station with de Witteville and the producer, Lunenfeld listed the five people in the world who could help them. The producer made him a bet. That night, Lunenfeld would send five telegrams inviting them to Geneva. If they accepted, de Witteville would pay for their travel and accommodations. If they declined, the producer would buy him two cases of his favorite wine, Chateauneuf du Pape. By the end of the next day, Lennonfeld had received affirmative responses from all but one. The guy from Scotland, Lennonfeld says, sent it by post. In the summer of 1953, Lennonfeld and his advisor had convened a murderer's row of endocrinologists, chemists, biologists, and others to develop standards, assay procedures, and purification methods for this miracle substance extracted from the urine of postmenopausal women. What to call it? The summit landed on human menopausal gonadotropin, or HMG, and they decided to call themselves the G Club. All the urine in the world. Nearly three decades prior to Lennonfeld's research, scientists had discovered gonadotropins, a family of peptide hormones that control ovarian and testicular functioning. They extracted these hormones from the blood of pregnant horses, dubbed pregnant mare serum gonadotropin, which could stimulate ovulation in humans when injected. But women treated with these gonadotropins also formed neutralizing antibodies. The urine-derived HMG, which contained a naturally occurring combination of FSH and LH, had no such limiting side effect. In a 2004 issue of the Human Reproductive Update Journal, Lennonfeld described the production of HMG as a relatively simple procedure. A chemist mixes menopausal urine with activated kaolin clay, shaken, not stirred. The suspension is left to settle at room temperature and then centrifuged. Liquid is discarded, kaolin is eluted, proteins are washed, acidified, precipitated, filtered, and treated. It wasn't the method of purification, but the means of collection that proved challenging. The average adult produces somewhere around 2 liters of urine per day. It takes about a day's supply of urine from 10 women in order to produce a single therapeutic dose, Lennonfeld told the Silicon Valley-founded nonprofit Israel 21C in 2012. In other words, one New York City water tower's worth would be needed to run clinical trials. To present his findings to Serono that spring day in 1957, the company had agreed to put Lennonfeld up for 3 nights in a very nice hotel, a beautiful little thing owned by the sister of someone in Serono management. But the discussions between Lennonfeld, Prince Pacelli, and Serono's chemist, Piero Donini, required more runway. For nearly 2 weeks, Pacelli took care of everything, Lennonfeld says, extending his hotel stay with full board for me. Lennonfeld remembers the prince as broad-minded and widely studied. By day, the men talked logistics. In the evening, Lennonfeld joined Donini at his home for dinner, presided over by a white-gloved servant. The head of Serono, Pietro Bertarelli, and his son Fabio, who would become CEO in 1965, were also present for discussions. A fanciful booklet that Serono produced in 1996, provided by the Merck Archive, paints the story of 7 people sitting around a table discussing the logistics of the proposed project. I need the urine of thousands of menopausal ladies, an anonymous interlocutor says. We can collect urine. We will collect urine. We need to collect urine. I need all the urine in the world. There could be no contamination of pregnancy, Lennonfeld tells me. The introduction of hormones from even one pregnant person would ruin the batch. In the immortal words of Mel Brooks, send in the nuns. We won't be hearing from these women, the linchpins to this story. Details on their exact location and order are lost to the maw of time, or perhaps buried as a line item in the Vatican archives. The Vatican did not respond to request for comment for this story. Given their already advanced age at the time of Serono's collection, it's safe to say that none are alive today, and few, if any, are likely to have direct familial descendants. A representative from Merck Serono declined to answer questions about the women, citing a lack of documentation. Lunenfeld never met them. Nuns present a special case in terms of memory and representation, since often their beliefs cause them to shy away from both, writes Flora Daronian, a lecturer at the University of Sussex. Her 2023 book, Women's Work in Postwar Italy, includes oral histories of nuns who lived in beautiful apostolic mother houses in Rome between 1945 and 1965, two of which functioned as retirement homes, where young novitiates cared for elderly sisters, likely a similar arrangement to the Casa di Riposo that Serono ended up tapping. Most would have entered the convent at age 18, having relinquished their given names and taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They slept in single rooms with a bed and a desk, ate simple meals, fasted on Fridays. They lived regimented days, focused on obedience to the Mother Superior and guided by the tolling of bells. On a call, Duronian describes the communal wardrobes the women shared from their black and white habits, some of which included a cornet, an elaborate veil, pointed almost like an admiral's hat, down to socks and undergarments. Their individuality was subsumed in the congregation, says Kathleen Sprouse Cummings, a professor at the University of Notre Dame who oversees the history of women religious, an academic organization devoted to the study of Catholic sisters. Even so-called particular attachments between nuns were discouraged. In exchange, Sprouse Cummings says they received a path to education and protection from unhappy marriages, divorce, and death by childbirth. Not only were they not pregnant, but would have never been pregnant, the vast majority of them, if not all of them. Serono's donors may have dwelled in the quiet halls of a contemplative convent which emphasized prayer, or an apostolic one whose sisters served in such roles as teachers, nurses, or seamstresses. Some made products, herbal medicines, biscuits. Others in Rome cleaned and cooked at the Vatican. The very elderly of all orders spent much of their time murmuring prayers. The structure of convent life would have been, at that point, essentially unchanged for centuries, says Sprouse Cummings, and the convents, she says, were bursting, their numbers nearing an all-time high. If the nuns in 1958 were informed of their new ministry at a time when everything was on the verge of changing, with the birth control pill, they might have seen it as a way to cement the Catholic teaching about how important it is to be open to babies and to have as many babies as possible. According to Lunenfeld, the nuns were Pacelli's fantastic idea. After days of mulling over logistics and behind-the-scenes talks, to which Lunenfeld was not privy, the prince took the proposal back to the Serono board, joined by Lunenfeld. He presented the project to them, and then he said, "The Pope is interested." Il nepotismo. At 5:30 p.m. on March 2, 1939, a puff of white smoke appeared from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, and then promptly turned black. Confusion reigned until, according to Inside the Vatican magazine, the secretary of the conclave sent a note to Vatican Radio that regardless of what color the smoke appeared to be, it was white. The cardinals had elected an inside man, the first Roman pope since the 18th century. Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli took his papal name, Pope Pius XII, on his 63rd birthday. The Pacellis, Don Giulio included, were members of the black nobility, aristocratic families with titles granted by the church, and deep loyalty to the papacy. Eugenia's grandfather, Marcantonio, had served as Minister of Foreign Affairs under Pope Pius IX, and in 1861 founded the Vatican newspaper Osservatore Romano. Eugenio's uncle Ernesto had founded the Banco di Roma in 1880, and in 1929 his elder brother Francesco, a legal advisor to Pope Pius XI, had negotiated the Lateran Treaty with Benito Mussolini, which granted Vatican City sovereign independence. Pius XII had a serious look to him, owl-like, with dark eyes made larger behind wire-rimmed glasses. His pale skin, as correspondent Corrado Pallenberg put it in his 1960 book Inside the Vatican, resembled old parchment, yet at the same time it had the surprisingly transparent effect, as if reflecting from the inside a cold white flame. Pius XII had served as an ecclesiastical ambassador to Germany under his predecessor, and was widely believed to have been elected due to his experience in diplomacy. A few days after his election, Pius received a congratulatory telegraph from Hitler. A rather cold and uncommunicative person, Pallenberg wrote of Pius, he did not feel at ease in the Vatican world. 95% of which consisted of easygoing, jovial Italians who enjoyed good food, amusing talk, and a bit of gossip. As a boy, one of Pius XII's favorite games had been pretending to give Mass. He surrounded himself with a group of confidants that included his personal doctors. The Bavarian nun, Mother Pascalina Lennart, his housekeeper for more than 40 years, and after Francesco died, his brother's adult sons. Plenty of popes kept family close. The word nepotism stems from Gregorio Leti's 1667 book Il Nepotismo di Roma, or The History of the Pope's Nephews. An often ribald account of the Renaissance-era golden age of popes, granting wealth, titles, and special privileges to their relatives, some of whom were whispered to be secret sons of the popes themselves. As in the case of Alexander VI, a barbarous, lascivious pope who took great delight to be embraced and caressed by fair ladies, whence the number of his bastards was very great. Of Pius's nephews, Carlo, the eldest, was regarded as the favorite. He alone, wrote Pallenberg, had access to the Pope's apartment for private meetings, but all enjoyed privileges, some of which began even before their uncle became the Lord's earthly shepherd. Marcantonio, the middle brother, presided over a flour mill, a sink and toilet manufacturer, and a real estate and construction empire. The youngest brother was the one and only Don Giulio Pacelli, a well-known man about the Vatican, as a reporter once described him. In 1940, Pius XII officiated Giulio's wedding in his private chapel. 3 years later, Giulio named his first son Eugenio after his uncle. Giulio was also a lawyer and a colonel in the Noble Guard, a group comprising sons of aristocratic families that saw no active military service, which did not stop him from wearing a uniform of a crisp, dark jacket with gilded embellishments and gold-fringed epaulettes, knee-high leather riding boots, a helmet, and a saber. Among his business positions, for which he favored the less flamboyant uniform of a dark suit over a white shirt and tie, Giulio was a representative to the administration of the Propaganda Fide, then the church's missionary arm. A member of the boards of both the railway Ferrovie del Sud-Est and the Pacelli-founded Banco di Roma, president of the Swiss arm of that bank, vice president of an Italian gas company, papal envoy to Costa Rica, and an executive committee member of Gherardo Cassini Editore, the house that incidentally published the Italian version of L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics in 1951. and for a time he was the president of a company on whose board he served for more than a decade, Istituto Farmacologico Serono. Land of Milk and Honey. On December 8, 1953, Pius XII celebrated a new pontifical initiative, the opening of the Church's inaugural Marian Year, aimed to revive Catholic faith and earnest devotion to the Mother of God, that the observant might conform their lives to the image of the same Virgin. The day was a triumph, but a few weeks later, Pius XII suffered a debilitating attack of hiccups, vomiting, and nausea, for which he sought treatment from one Paul Nyhans. The Swiss surgeon and former Protestant minister practiced a controversial rejuvenation treatment. At the Clinique La Prairie on Lake Geneva, he injected the buttocks of his famous patients, rumored to include King George VI, Hedda Hopper, and Somerset Maugham, with the cells of fetal lambs and calves, delivered via cesarean section from the bodies of their freshly slaughtered mothers. For the Pope, he made house calls. By the power of God, Nyhans' ministrations, or pure luck, Pius XII recovered, only for his illness to fell him again in late 1954. His doctors and nephews arrived at his bedside, believing the end was near. But a week later, the Pope was asking for an egg. Tell him he can have not only one egg, but two, Time reported a gastrointestinal specialist telling his personal physician, and have them flipped with Marsala if he agrees. Conception, immaculate and otherwise, was much on Pius XII's mind in the final years of his life. The Second World Congress on Fertility and Sterility, for which Lennenfeld's own Professor de Watteville was one of 12 committee members, convened in Naples on May 18, 1956, for a 9-day summit. Some 180 paper presentations, excursions to Amalfi and Pompeii, parties and fashion shows to entertain the ladies, and a special pilgrimage to Rome for an address from the Pope. It is entirely true that your zeal to pursue research on marital infertility and the means to overcome it, Pius XII told his listeners, as translated from the original Latin by Ronald L. Conte, Jr., engages high spiritual and ethical values, which should be taken into account. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.